Is nationalism about how much you're willing to sacrifice for your country, or about whether your country is even worth the sacrifice? Throughout history, leaders have called on their people to give everything for the nation. But what happens when the nation itself fails its people? Is the nation still worth fighting for? What happens when devotion is no longer a two-way street? And ladies and gentlemen, this is exactly where Indonesia is heading. Hashtag KaburAjaDulu is taking Indonesia by storm. The hashtag encourages Indonesians to leave the country to emigrate in search of a better life. And as a Gen Z struggling with rising costs, authoritarian backsliding, and the impossibility of climbing the socio-economic ladder, I'd say it's about damn time. But wait, does running away actually solve anything? Many Indonesians abroad post their seemingly perfect lives on TikTok, making it seem like life overseas is automatically better. But let's take a step back and think. Because let me tell you why blindly chasing the KaburAjaDulu dream is a terrible idea. MBAs from Ivy League schools are struggling to find jobs. We're talking about graduates from Harvard, Yale, Brown, Columbia, graduates from some of the most elite institutions in the world. What makes you and your fresh undergraduate ass think you can even stand a chance? Okay, let's say you're not looking for high-skilled jobs. You're willing to take low-skill service work instead. Well, good luck competing to become a tradie in Australia, where even tradesmen often have degrees and certifications. But gods forbid you to end up in Hong Kong, Malaysia, Oman, Qatar, or Saudi Arabia, where many migrant workers are reduced to nothing more than modern-day slaves. Instead of KaburAjaDulu, maybe it's time to MikirAjaDulu. But I completely understand why so many young Indonesians feel like they have no other choice. Because this whole hashtag KaburAjaDulu trend isn't just some random social media hype. It's the result of Indonesia's broken system. And Indonesia's broken system is what Indonesia Gelap, a viral movement, wishes to shine its light towards. So let's talk about it. What exactly is Indonesia Gelap? Indonesia Gelap, or Dark Indonesia, is a series of online protests that shows heavy concern over the direction the government is heading towards. So what exactly are people worried about in this mess? Well, first, Prabowo, being a big guy, has a big kink for making big things. One of the things that he wants to make big is the government. Between 2019 and 2024, Indonesia had only 34 ministers. And when Prabowo became president, he inflated those numbers from 34 to 48 ministers. His reasoning is that he said Indonesia is a country that is as big as the entirety of Europe with a large population. Bro, listen. I know I voted for you during the elections, but come on, let's be for real. India, the biggest country in the world in terms of population, 30 ministers. China, second biggest country, 26 ministers. America, the world's superpower, although we all know they're fumbling, 15 secretaries. Russia, the biggest country in the world in terms of landmass, 32 ministers. So exactly what excuse do you have to have 48 ministers serving inside the cabinet, big bro? Let's be for real. The real reason for this oversized cabinet is political survival. Prabowo needs to keep all the political elites happy. And Dasko happily orchestrated the cabinet layout to secure loyalty and stability, not for the people, but for the elite class. Okay, you can say that you promised to give us a cabinet of technocrats, aka Zakon cabinet in Dutch. But bro, you keep on giving us the bottom of the barrel. Like Bahlil as the Minister of Energy and Resources that has already fumbled massively. Deddy Corbuzier, who, mind you, this guy's a pretty entertaining podcaster, but what business does he have in the Ministry of Defense as an advisor? Even Rudy Valinka, who got a job in the Ministry of Information solely for glazing the government. Obviously, you're giving out these jobs to only your friends. And this is at the cost of our national budget, which Indonesia plans on making things efficient. Indonesia's government claims it's all about efficiency, which in corporate language means we're cutting costs. But at the same time, they're expanding the government, which definitely runs on taxes. Who pays for this bloated system? Well, obviously us. And Sri Mulyani, arguably one of the few competent figures left in this administration, is being held back from doing her job. The government is running out of money, and she's trying to secure more revenue. But instead of support, she's getting backlash from both the government and the public for actually trying to fix this mess. Indonesia has become a walking contradiction after 10 years under this guy, Jokowi. Meanwhile, government officials continue abusing their power, blocking roads with their convoys, causing traffic jams for ordinary people, living lavishly while dismissing the struggles of everyday Indonesians, mocking a small iced tea vendor just because he didn't make sales for that day. All while ordinary Indonesians are experiencing mass layoffs, a shrinking job market, and economic hardship. Many Gen Zs in Indonesia can't find stable jobs and can't make enough money to survive. Some are even turning to online gambling or even MeChat prostitution just to keep the bills paid. All the government can do is to continue squeezing money from the already shrinking middle class. And I'm sorry if this continues, then we would all be equally poor, just like the socialist paradise that is North Korea. And while the government adds 14 extra ministers to secure their political survivor, millions of young Indonesians can't even survive the job market. This doesn't look like governance, it looks like a Godfather protection racket. Anyways, the fuse that lit up the tinderbox wasn't some angry Gen Z going on the streets screaming and shouting for change. Rather, it's something more calculated and more mundane. A few days before he got reshuffled, Satrio Brojonegoro informed public university presidents that their TUKIN, which is a legal slush fund for civil servants, is being slashed due to efficiency. When the government slashes university funding, what do universities do? They stop keeping students from protesting. And protests, they did. Massive protests erupted across Jakarta and some few other cities, worsening traffic, dirtying up the streets, creating an economic boom around street vendors who sell cigarettes and iced tea. And I swear to God, the government has to give the people less excuse to protest, because 3 days ago I was stuck in a 3-hour traffic jam just because of this bullshit. And people got even angry when some of the ministers that they wanted gone weren't reshuffled by Prabowo. Congratulations, Bahlil! Your presence on the stock market is the only reason Prabowo didn't bring down the ban hammer. And why is Prabowo trying to slash TUKIN funding in the first place? Why does he want to do government efficiency? Let me get to that. The root of Prabowo's issue lies in the belief of protectionism. Indonesia's protectionist stance on its market and economy is the result of a paranoia fueled Sukarno, who didn't want the West nor the East back in the Cold War to take advantage of Indonesia's poor markets. Having suffered colonialism, Sukarno did not want Indonesia to experience colonialism through economic leverage. Somewhere down the line around the post-Suharto era, protectionism is used by business and political and bureaucratic elites to block competition and monopolize the market through the government and state partners. Susi Pujiastuti actually implied this to be the case when she states that the government monopolizes logistics of airplanes and the aviation industry in one of her tweets. The thing is, protectionist regulation in Indonesia has become so layered that businesses have to undercut bureaucracy through corruption. And so regulation in Indonesia no longer serves to protect the market, rather to incentivize actors to cut the regulation using bribery and favors to benefit of those enforcing the regulations. This creates an entire bureaucracy that is dependent on money or favors to run. And this model of governance scares away investors from funneling foreign direct investment into Indonesia. A South Korean diplomat on an interview in KBS once said that his quote-unquote friend dealt with Indonesian businessmen and government officials and noted that they have way too many doors to knock on and that they're also dishonest. Meanwhile, FDI is seen as a good thing because it opens up doors for more jobs in Indonesia. So increasing FDIs would open up more and more job markets in Indonesia to deal with the Gen Z job crisis. And right now, there is a total amount of 79 million Gen Zs living in Indonesia. And in order to attract more FDIs, Prabowo would need to lessen regulation. And in order to lessen regulation, Prabowo would need to reform the bureaucracy. And in order to reform the bureaucracy, Prabowo would need to fight the alleged network of corrupt bureaucrats that maintains the system for corruption. Prabowo wants to change the governmental budgeting system. What Is Up Indonesia did a fantastic job breaking down the numbers and the math of Prabowo's efficiency, so you should definitely check out their post to see specific budget allocations, but I'll fill in the blanks on the political side of things. Every year, ministries and agencies get a fixed annual budget allocation. If a ministry does not use up its allocated budget, the government assumes that 1. The ministry didn't need that much money, so next year's budget may be reduced. 2. The ministry is inefficient or inactive, leading to political scrutiny. As a result, bureaucrats and their political ministers rush to spend everything and often leading to wasteful last-minute expenditures instead of efficient impact-driven programs. And at the end of every fiscal year, there's often a sudden spike in unnecessary infrastructure projects, training programs, or even events just to absorb the remaining budget before December 31st. Some of that money leads back to the pockets of bureaucrats who have the power to determine vendors and services. I really have no idea why Indonesia's key performance index is so weird, but I do agree that this needs to be changed if we want to cut any deficits. Anyways, if this is exactly what Prabowo wants to do, then he will have targeted more than just bureaucrats, but also politicians. The thing is, Indonesia's bureaucracy keeps a system that sustains on corruption. And bureaucrats are often covered by their political ministers. Indonesia's government bureaucracy is deeply intertwined with political elites and business interests. Large budgets create opportunities for kickbacks, markups, and inflated contracts that benefit politically connected businesses. Ministries and agencies often prioritize programs that facilitate financial leakage rather than those with real public benefits. For example, $500 billion infrastructure project might absorb its entire budget, but was it efficient or just a way to channel funds to contractors linked to officials? And this is how many investigative journalists and Crime Watch accuse how political parties make money. They funnel ministry money into partners in crime that return some of the shares' allocated budget back to the politician. A prime example of this case is Johnny G. Pate's mega corruption scandal, where he had partners serving as vendors where he funneled money into building network towers in the rural areas. Let's cut it there. If I tell you guys more, I essentially taught you guys how to do corruption. But officials watching this video, this is an example, not a fact. I'm merely giving people a step-by-step what-if scenario of how politicians can do corruption. It's for educational purposes, so if you arrest me, that will completely prove my point. Then really, having spent half of my life going to school and getting scores based on results, I see this way of scoring work performance highly erratic. Ministries are rarely judged by actual outcomes, such as how many people benefited, how much economic growth it generated, how efficient was the spending. Instead, the primary performance metric is budget absorption. If 100% is spent, the program is deemed successful regardless of its real-world impact. A ministry may claim a rural development program was quote-unquote successful because the budget was spent. But if villagers still lack clean water, was it really a success?
Ya nggak tahu.
So in the end, I understand how Prabowo's efficiency works, and by choking the budget allocation, he's pretty much reaped half the soul of bureaucrats. But to only target his suppression towards civil servants wouldn't be effective in the long run, since the network of corruption extends far more than just bureaucrats, and the list of people involved are too many, not to mention the collateral damage that he could potentially wrought. And you think the situation is already messy? Think again. Just after the Dark Indonesia movement began, Prabowo did a communication fumble, as usual, and announced the creation of the Danantara, a sovereign wealth fund agency. So, what exactly is a sovereign wealth fund? Well, for you people that can't Google, let me explain to you in simple terms. Imagine Prabowo is your dad. The allowance money you get from him is the national budget. Then one day, he cut half of your allowance and used that allowance to invest in some random street vendor in hopes that the street vendor would make money for Prabo passively by selling iced tea. That is exactly what a sovereign wealth fund is. It's basically money allocated from the national budget to be used to invest in some random business. I don't know. I'm no economist, but Ferry Irwandi managed to make a breakdown of how it works on Twitter, and I think it's effective. And yes, we copy-pasted this off from Malaysia's Khazanah and Singapore's Temasek. Of course, being a free market laissez-faire capitalist developmentalist, this is a good news because we finally have something to leverage our bottomless wallets for. But of course, not even a day I'm disappointed. The government expresses that Jokowi, social organizations like Pancasila Youth and religious organizations like Nahdlatul Ulama to act as the auditors. These three names are the last people you ever want to count your money on, and I don't have to tell you why. Not to shit on their capabilities, because I'm pretty sure that they're good at something else. But how do you expect an Islamic communal cleric to audit something so sophisticated like a sovereign wealth fund that's going to funnel their money into something like drilling holes into the bottom of the earth in Russia? And just like that, all of Indonesia was enraged. Not only are young Indonesians angry, poor, struggling, and fed up with the blatant nepotism, but Danantara could have been Indonesia's Temasek or Norway's oil fund. Instead, we're putting the country's wealth into the hands of the same people who treat the national budget like their personal ATM. It's like asking a compulsive gambler to manage your life savings and then wondering why you end up bankrupt. This is just another Najib Razak and John Lowe's 1MD Berhad scandal just waiting to explode. Your people are literally struggling to survive. They need money more than ever, and the least you can do is give them a better oversight system for this sovereign wealth fund. Or else the government is just gonna play online gambling, and when the house loses, we get to pay for the loss. And everything I said pretty much encapsulates why young Gen Z Indonesians are angry and frustrated. Because it seems like the government doesn't have a clear picture of what it wants to be. You said you guys want to be efficient, but why are you guys increasing the government? You said you want to fight the root of corruption, but why are you taking on one aspect of it only? You said you want a cabinet filled with experts, but why is it filled with professional ass-lickers? That in itself is why many Indonesians feel disillusioned and why many expresses the desire to move out. The grass is greener on the other side for this case. And I disagree with many of our government officials that questions our lack of nationalism. Nationalism means giving it all for our country. But let me spell out to you what this country is right now. Indonesia is a country that cannot determine whether it's socialist, capitalist, or mixed. With a society that struggles with critical thinking and poor education, we lost to India, by the way, where the job market is hard and the older generation labeling the changes of the younger generation with extreme prejudice that claims itself to be secular yet is an Islamic state in all but name. Has a diverse population of people yet racism is still rampant in the unconscious mind that sees its people as a commodity to be extracted rather than as an asset to be invested, that claims to be progressive is actually conservative, where only those who are a part of the 5% or knows the 5% could advance through leverage and ass-kissing alone, that claims to fight for the people yet is receiving oligarch money, a country that is comfortable in their squalor and never desires to be anything greater, a people that punishes standing out and competition, where honesty is taught by dishonesty is applauded, where democracy has a price tag and is only available to rich people, where speaking English is considered arrogant. This is the Indonesia that many Gen Z see, a society that doesn't allow them to be anything more. How exactly could you convince Gen Zs to give their lives for this country, a generation built on the internet, information, and critical thinking? We have 79 million Gen Zs in Indonesia. That's 79 million dreams, talents, and ambition held hostage by a broken system. And the real tragedy, it's not just corruption stealing from us. It's the fact that by the time we're old enough to lead, there might be nothing left to save. There is your answer, people. The reason why Gen Zs and more younger millennials are lacking nationalism is not because of their own volition, but rather because the conditions are lacking for us to evolve and improve. Really, there is no question of whether we love this country or not. You guys spent 12 years indoctrinating it into our genes through formal education. We most definitely love this country, but we do not feel that this country loves us. Let's talk about love and relationships for a bit. Often, when people are drowning in their own problems, they become blind to the damage they cause to the people who love them the most. Not because they don't care, but because their world is so clouded by their own pain, fears, or insecurities that they can't see beyond it. But here's the harsh reality. Love does not fix people who refuse to see their own wounds. You can support, encourage, and love them, but if they never recognize the problem, if they never take responsibility, then you are left carrying both their own burdens and your own pain. At some point, you have to ask yourself, is this love or is it self-sacrifice at your own expense? Loving someone should not mean losing yourself in the chaos, which is why the best thing to do in moments such as these is to leave. So please, you can take away everything, but don't take away our hope for the future. Don't turn us into Eastern Europe, because I don't want to have to live with the same level of cynicism as Gatsu and living ironically in Eastern Europe. But a government staffed by old people, more concerned with the wealth preservation and extraction, I think a generational gap will become more and more of a problem. And for that, I implore all Gen Zs in Indonesia to come together and create a forum where we can at least discuss issues, politics, policy, society, and everything so that we can provide at least feedback to the nation of how it is impacting us as a people. I've created a forum called Indonesia Bebas Bersuara, and I really do hope it takes off in the future. And I invite any Gen Zs from all sides of society to participate in this forum, just like the Youth Congress of the olden days, where we can determine exactly what we want from this nation and build the Indonesian dream. For what is nationalism if the country is not worth dying for? So let's begin making nationalism great again. Thank you for watching this episode of the Base Indonesian Show. Don't forget to click like and subscribe. Don't forget to join my Discord server. And let's make Indonesia great.
Subscribe to the Base Indonesian Show. Jamin Halal.